Today on Maine Calling, some good news from the world of birds. We've all heard about the shocking and discouraging decline in bird populations worldwide, but there are also bird conservation success stories to celebrate. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, what has worked in bird conservation? Why is that important to humankind? And what can these successful efforts teach us about saving other species? In his new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, author and researcher Scott Weidensall writes about bird species that are thriving, some of which once neared extinction. He and UNE bird conservation expert Noah Perlett join us to discuss some of the inspirational projects and people who have been saving birds for decades. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Highland Green, committed to fostering a resident-driven, active lifestyle community for those 55 and better. HighlandGreenLifestyle.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum school recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There is plenty of discouraging environmental news, that's for sure, but today we are going to focus on something that's going well, bird conservation efforts that succeeded. Joining me for the hour, ornithologist Scott Weidensall, who has written more than 30 books, including Living on the Wind, Across the Hemisphere with Migratory Birds. His new book is The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. And also with us for the hour, Dr. Noah Perlett, who is Assistant Academic Director of the School of Marine and Environmental Programs at the University of New England. He is also President of the Nuttall Ornithological Club. I knew I was going to do that. The oldest ornithological organization in the Americas. We invite you to share your comments and questions. Zara, bird species you're particularly interested in, one that's actually seen its population grow, or is there another species you're concerned about? Are you involved in efforts to protect birds? You can send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. And Scott, congratulations on the book. I'm not even going to ask you how you've written 30 books. That's do you sleep?
Thank you. It's fun. I love birds. I've been involved with bird conservation for years. I love sharing birds with other people. So it's really, writing books about it is not a hardship.
Well, you mentioned you've been doing this a long time, and so let's get the bad news out of the way and ask you about that. Your book, your first book, the one I just mentioned, came out in 1999. So here we are 20 years later in this 2019 when that devastating landmark Cornell study came out, the one that found that the North American bird population was down by almost 3 billion years, birds in 50 years. What was your reaction? You weren't surprised, were you?
Oh, no, it was a gut punch. I wasn't surprised. I think everybody was taken aback to have it quantified like that. But, you know, anybody who's been birding for more than a few decades has seen this sort of hollowing out of spring migration and the dawn chorus. And yeah, I want to preface our conversation today by saying I'm not suggesting things are great for birds, because they're not. We've got a lot of birds that are in crisis. But there's a real danger in despair, in just feeling hopeless, you know, because you give up. And, you know, I'm in my 60s, and I've seen in my lifetime how we can bring back species of birds that we thought were gone. I graduated high school in 1976, the bicentennial year. That year, there were maybe 1,000 bald eagles in the lower 48. Maine was one of the few places that had even a remnant bald eagle population in the East. If you had told me 50 years ago that when we were celebrating the 250th birthday of the country in 2026, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles in the lower 48, I would have thought that was delusional. And yet, here we are. We brought back ospreys, we brought back peregrine falcons. We've seen over the last century or so a tremendous resurgence in waterfowl populations. We know how to bring back bird populations if we put the time and the effort and the money and the regulatory muscle into it. We've done it before and we can do it again.
Noah, do you agree with that? That there's danger in despair?
Absolutely. That number from the 2019 paper that you're citing is both eye-opening for the volume of it, but it's also a little bit scary because it can be used in so many misleading ways, right? In that there's so many species of birds in so many different habitats, and our effects on them really varies across those habitats, those geographies, and the birds' life histories, meaning whether they're migratory or resident. And so there's just that's one story, a big picture story, but nestled within that, there's thousands and thousands of other stories to tell, and both stories in the past, present, but most important, stories of the future, sort of as what Scott's alluding to, our potential to have positive impact on bird populations.
Have you all, in the work that you've done, seen a difference in the public's attitude since this number? Was it a wake-up call, should I say, too? And I'll turn to you, Scott. Do you feel as though there are more people focused on the kind of things that you have been focused on your entire life?
I think so, because particularly because that paper came out right before the pandemic. And one of the things that we saw during the COVID pandemic was an explosion in interest in birding. People were stuck at home. They could go outside safely when they couldn't do anything else. And the world quieted down and bird song kind of came to the fore. So it was this twin experience of more people realizing what birds bring into their lives, but also the recognition. And I have to say, the folks that were involved at Cornell and elsewhere in that study did a really masterful job of getting the word out as widely as possible. But they didn't stop there. Many of the folks that were involved in that 2019 paper then turned to figuring out what to do about it. And they started something called the Road to Recovery, which has been going on ever since. And it's the idea is to marshal as much information as we have, figure out where the problems are, and start to address them, as Noah said, on a species by species basis, because every bird species, and there's 11,000 of them in the world, has a slightly different, ecological niche, a slightly different life history, a slightly different suite of threats and opportunities. But we also benefit from the fact that we have so much more information today at our fingertips about bird populations. eBird, every year bird watchers upload about 100 million birding checklists to eBird. We have this extraordinarily rich mosaic of data on what species of birds are where in what numbers at what time of the year, increasingly around the world. And there's been an explosion in new tracking technology. I know that's something that Noah's been very involved in, as well as I. That's giving us, in some cases, almost a second by second window into the lives of these birds, where they're going, what habitats they're using, giving us an idea of where the problems lie and how we can start to fix it. And in some cases, we're fixing it. One of the species that we've been concerned about for decades are wood thrushes, which are one of the most beloved forest songbirds in the East. This gorgeous, lovely, fluting, melodic songs. And their numbers have been going down and down and down and down and down for decades. But we've turned that around. eBird data suggests in the last 10 years, wood thrush populations have come up significantly across almost their entire range. Now, they're still in trouble here in New England, and we're not really sure why. But some of the new tracking technology, the MODIS wildlife tracking system that Noah's been involved in, is, I think, going to give us the information we need to solve those problems and figure out how we can bring wood thrushes back fully.
And Noah, why don't you talk about some of that tracking technology? What has it been able to teach us in recent years? Maybe give us an example or two of something you found out that you didn't know.
Yeah, it's just an absolute revolution in science, in conservation. It's remarkable, really starting since around 2008 with a seminal paper that Bridget Stutchberry and colleagues published. And one of the reasons that we've learned so much is because the technology has done two things. One, it's tiny. So the miniaturization allows you to put it on so many different animals, so many different bird species. And then the second is that it's relatively inexpensive. You know, so a tracking device could cost anywhere from $150 up to a couple thousand dollars, depending on the type of tracking device that you're using. You know, and so some of the things that you just asked about, what we've learned, you know, places where we see animals in Maine in the summer, and we don't have no idea where they go. There was an amazing satellite tracking project done by Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife with great blue herons. You know, finding that great blue herons were leaving Maine and flying to Florida or Cuba and the Dominican Republic in that area, and not only flying there, but sometimes taking oceanic flights. So flying directly over the ocean rather than doing little stops along the way. You know, that's for a huge bird, right? You know, comparatively, other studies of really small birds, like I study a bird called the bobolink. Bobolinks are 30 grams. So 30 grams are like two strawberries, right? And we have these birds that are flying directly from the Massachusetts coast nonstop all the way to Venezuela in a single migratory flight. And to think about the ability to do that, the energetics and all the things that gets that they have to do to prepare for that successful flight is just absolutely mind-bending.
I do want to talk about some of the specific conservation's success stories, but I also want to talk about the bigger picture, because the subtitle of your book, Scott, is Saving Birds to Save the Planet. And you argue that, and pardon the pun, that bird conservation isn't just for the birds, that what is good for bird species is good for humans. How so?
Well, because there are so many birds. Literally every square meter of the Earth's surface has birds on it at some time of the year. You know, they range in over such distances, such ecological complexity. So a world that supports birds is going to work for everything, including us. So, you know, and I grew up in the coal region of eastern Pennsylvania, the anthracite region, where they used literal canaries in the coal mine. You know, birds are the ideal ecological barometer. They're common. People see them. People pay attention to them. They're easy to observe. And you can monitor the health of the wider environment by monitoring the health of bird populations. And right now the birds are telling us that the environment is in trouble. So if we start to make, you know, rational choices about how we're protecting and stewarding and restoring the planet, birds will tell us whether or not that's working.
All right. So let's talk about some of the success stories. And you start the book by talking about waterfowl, about ducks and geese. And we need a little bit of a history lesson to understand how we've been able to turn things around. Fascinating to me, Scott, though, I did not realize that there were so few waterfowl at the turn of the last century. What had been going on?
We were shooting everything with feathers is what was going on. There was an enormous demand through the market for birds. And I'm talking about not just big plump game birds like waterfowl and pheasants and grouse and things like that, but, you know, for the market, for sale, for food, people were shooting songbirds, people were shooting shorebirds. Literally, I mean, sparrows, you could walk into the markets in Boston and buy sparrows to eat. But waterfowl really took it on the chin. And so by the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, at the peak of the waterfowl market hunting period, we were killing about somewhere between 100 and 200 million birds a year in North America, killing them for food, killing them for feathers.
Repeat that
Waterfowl hunting.
number. Repeat that number. How many birds are we killing?
100 million to 200 million birds a year. It was just this juggernaut of destruction. And so, waterfowl populations crashed. And this was the same, they've been, they're being slaughtered. They were using things like punt guns, which are these 10 or 12 foot long shotguns that weighed as much as 100 pounds, packed with a couple of pounds of black powder and mounted on the bow of a boat. And the market hunter would skull out at night under the cover of darkness and get close to resting rafts of ducks and touch off one of these explosions. And they might kill, anywhere from 50 to 100 ducks in one shotgun blast from these punt guns. So, you can imagine with that kind of carnage, the population was dropping really, really fast. And by the turn of the last century, there was concern that, even common species like mallards and pintails were going to be gone. I mean, and understandably, I mean, we'd lost passenger pigeons completely, which was the most abundant bird in North America. Carolina parakeets were on the cusp of extinction. So, in the early 20th century, the nascent Audubon Society movement, which started with Massachusetts Audubon and then spread across the country, people started lobbying their elected representatives in Washington to protect birds. And it was a top to bottom effort, school kids writing letters to their congresspeople. And slowly that began to change. There was federal legislation that made it illegal to kill most wild migratory birds. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is still sort of the foundational bedrock law at the federal level protecting our wild birds. So market hunting was eliminated. And then, just as things started to turn around a little bit, we hit the Dust Bowl and that massive drought in the 1930s. And wetland habitats began to disappear and waterfowl populations collapsed further. But we were also in the Great Depression, and a lot of the land that had been plowed up to create the Dust Bowl should never have been plowed in the first place. And so the federal government was able to step in and at fire sale prices buy up millions of acres of land for the National Wildlife Refuge System. And so we started to see this slow recovery of waterfowl in the first half of the 20th century. And duck seasons went in, people had to buy a license. You couldn't just go out and shoot them, you couldn't sell them. Things were looking pretty good. And then after World War II, we saw this rapid industrialization of the country and things began to sag again for waterfowl. We lost more and more wetland habitat out there. And then it really hit kind of a rock bottom in the 1980s. We'd lost so much wetland habitat. We were in the midst of another continental drought. Duck populations had fallen to the lowest level the Fish and Wildlife Service had ever recorded since the 1950s. And that's when we as a society decided to change things. Congress passed the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, or NACA. We entered into the first ever transnational conservation agreement with Canada through the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. And we started pouring a lot of money into wetland restoration and wetland protection. The federal government began protecting wetlands, which had been disappearing at a rate of about 60 acres an hour for more than 200 years, just to put that wetland loss in perspective. And man, we were off to the races, by the 1980s. And I should say that in 1988, when the New York Times sort of announced this big international waterfowl conservation plan, nobody knew if it was going to work. And a lot of the top waterfowl biologists in the United States actually didn't think it would. They thought we were going to lose a lot of these species of ducks. But they came roaring back. These are birds that have a high reproductive potential, and they can lay a lot of eggs and make a lot of babies when conditions are right. And sometimes almost too many. We can talk about geese, which is probably
That's right. Well, it's
one.
just so interesting because if somebody's younger and they're listening to this program and they,
encounter geese in their town park, or they, are just used to having ducks around, it might be hard for them to get their head around that it was really within a very recent time frame that these species have come back from a really scary place.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we do need to take another quick break. You can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, bird conservation, especially efforts that have worked. My guest, Dr. Noah Perlett, who's Assistant Academic Director for UNE School of Marine and Environmental Programs, and Scott Weidensahl, who is an ornithologist and author whose new book is The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Join the conversation. What do you want to know about helping bird populations survive and thrive? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And I should mention, Scott, I saw that you are speaking in Maine on May 1st at Maine Audubon.
I am. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Okay. And that's open to the public, right?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, you were talking before about the fact that a series of legislative victories over the 20th century really led to the restoration of many of the waterfowl we're familiar with. And I want to turn to you, Noah, because I know a lot of the work that you do is with songbirds in grassland environments. And I'm wondering if there's a similar story, if there are specific legislative decisions or regulations that have made, had an extraordinary impact on songbirds.
They have, absolutely. And in a lot of respects, there's really fantastic news in Maine. A study was just recently published about, from colleagues at Tufts University and our Climate Common, where they went out and surveyed 250,000 acres of industrial forest land in northern Maine. And they had surveyed this area 30 years ago. And what they found was truly remarkable, because it was very different than what the national trends for songbirds are, in that they found that of the 47 species that they were studying, 55% of them, their populations had actually grown over that time period, not even stayed stable. Another about 30% of the species had stayed stable. So that's great. But the fact that they're actually being able to document population growth of these species was such great news for really the stewardship of Maine forests. And the challenge with telling that story is because these are, frankly, animals that are largely hidden to the general public. Very few birders travel into these woods because they're so remote. We see them on migration in the spring and fall, but that's a different kind of story than actually seeing them on the breeding grounds, where they have communities of birds that are interacting across all these different forest types.
And now, to what do they attribute the success story? Why? Why are these populations growing?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, largely because, not because the forests are left alone. In fact, that's the opposite result that they found, and the big concerning result that they found, but rather that the forests have remained as forests. Okay, so they've been managed, they've been cut in lots of different styles of forest management, but they haven't been developed, and where that's a total loss of habitat. And so the birds have largely been able to adjust and work with it. And within that story is a really important story that they have had a really hard time finding what they would consider to be really mature forests. That while the northern forest has a lot of forest cover, it has very little old forests. And for the species that rely on those older forests, that's a really more challenging problem that we'll have to think about from a management perspective.
All right. And Scott, the story that Noah told is not the only success story that's focused here in Maine. In your book, you talk about everybody's favorite bird, the Atlantic puffin.
That's right. And I suspect most people who are listening to Maine Calling know the story of how Steve Kress and the folks at Project Puffin at the National Audubon Society brought puffins back to Eastern Egg Rock in Muskungus Bay back in the 1970s. But the story doesn't stop there. I mean, what I think a lot of Mainers don't understand is that the techniques that Steve and the Project Puffin people developed to bring puffins back to Eastern Egg Rock, predator exclusion, translocation of chicks, bringing the chicks down from the big puffin colonies in Canada, and what's known as social attraction, putting out decoys and audio lures that have the mimic the sounds of an active seabird colony. Those techniques are being used all over the world with, I think the last time I checked, 138 species of endangered seabirds, albatrosses and storm petrels and shearwaters, pelicans, herons and egrets. It was a revolution in seabird conservation, and it started right here in Maine.
Mm. And you tell a story about its legacy in Hawaii.
That's right. In fact, the very first place that social attraction was used on seabird conservation was on the island of Kauai. A fellow named Rich Podolsky, who Rich still lives in Maine, he's still involved in seabird research. He was doing his PhD, and he helped the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service create a new Laysan albatross colony on the high cliffs at Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge in the north end of the island of Kauai. They were using decoys, they were using audio lures, and it was successful. And that was kind of proof of concept for this. And man, it's just like, it was like pulling the cork out of the bottle at that point. And it's been used, as I said, with critically endangered species that, you know, like Chinese crested terns, which were at one point thought to be extinct, and a tiny little colony was rediscovered. And by using social attraction, they were able to pull those birds into a safe nesting place. It's proven to be a really flexible and highly effective technique for seabird conservation.
We'll go to Sal, who's calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Sal, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello? Oh, okay. I didn't hear anything. Hi there. I have a double question. One is it good to feed birds all year long? And is there anything specific we should or shouldn't be doing? I feed them all year long. That's one. The other one is there's on Etsy, there's a person, a guy in the UK, who's selling crow parts, and people are buying them. I would like to suggest, please don't buy crow parts and don't encourage this mental case to kill crows in the UK.
Sal, thanks for your question. Who wants to chime in on the first one? Whether or not it's okay, good, bad, indifferent to have a bird feeder?
Yeah, so it's perfectly fine to have a bird feeder out year round. You know, the caveat to that is not necessarily not having a bird feeder, but making sure that it's clean and cleaned on a regular basis, particularly for lots of finches that have the potential to pass on diseases at bird feeders, really trying to minimize those impacts. You know, but I mean, bird feeders really make up a relatively speaking small percentage of a songbird's diet, in that, you know, it's kind of like fast food. You know, maybe it's 15% or less of their diet. And so, you know, it's not a big deal one way or the other. Yet it really dramatically increases our enjoyment of these birds. And when that increases our enjoyment, I think that will translate hopefully to conservation actions more broadly speaking.
And to Sal's second question, I'll turn to you, Scott. And I just did a quick search and found actually several sources where someone can buy a taxidermied crow on the internet. I agree with her. This does not sound like a good idea. Is it problematic?
Well, the sad part is crows are not protected in the UK. In fact, they're killed routinely. Predator control operations on some of these big game shooting reserves. So I would vote with my pocketbook and absolutely not buy those things. We'd rather people leave wild birds in the wild.
And speaking of crows, John has sent us an email. He writes, I just want to put in a good word for crows and corvids. They are extremely intelligent. They have absolutely fascinating social structures and are ubiquitous in urban settings. There's a massive murder of crows that lives in Lewiston, and sometimes people are apprehensive about them or scared of them. I love it when they visit my backyard and encourage others to rethink their opinions of them. They are beautiful, intelligent birds. So Scott is, crows have long been something that show up in movies and books as something scary and ominous. Is that reputation something that, well, I want to ask you about birds, has that, crows, whether that's really affected the population over the years, but also whether that's a case with other birds as well?
Yeah, I think crows suffer from the fact that they're large, they're loud, they're black. People can, you know, if they show up at feeders, they can be perceived as bullies. But as John said, corvids, the crows and ravens and jays and magpies are among the most intelligent birds in the world as we measure intelligence. And it's important to remember that there are many different kinds of intelligences, and all birds are intelligent to varying degrees depending on their environment. But if folks are interested in learning more, I cannot highly recommend enough the works of Bernd Heinrich, renowned Maine naturalist author who has yet another book out. And you want to talk about a prolific author, but Dr. Heinrich has been doing work on crows and ravens and their intelligence for years and years and years, and has some wonderful books like The Mind of the Raven and Ravens in Winter that will tell you a lot more about that group of birds, give you a much better appreciation for them.
I'm grinning because Bernd Heinrich has been on Maine Calling, and he had to find a payphone to join us. And the payphone he went to wasn't working, so he ran to the next payphone he ran like 6 miles to the next payphone. Wonderful program.
There's a long distance marathon running. So
that's
and showed up a Maine Calling with a little huffing and puffing. It was really quite a program.
That story definitely checks out.
So we're going to go here to John, an email from John. Can you talk a bit about the success story of bringing turkeys back to Maine? Noah, you cannot drive down the turnpike without seeing turkeys. And in fact, I think on the turnpike, I've had a state trooper tell me they're a bit of a hazard. They go through windshields. But tell us what you can about the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Turkeys were broadly extirpated from the state and reintroduced multiple times in the 1900s from different populations. I believe they were brought from Vermont, southern Vermont, and the Catskills of New York, and reintroduced largely in southern Maine, and just have gone bananas, and in a good way. They have just spread far and wide, everywhere from the big state parks in the central state all the way to the coastal areas to down east in the southern part. And their success has been just remarkable. And you're right, they're not shy about their success, whether it's on the highways or gobbling right now in small fields or urban parks. They're doing amazing. And it's a real joy to see. And in fact, and that's really also a national trend. I mean, turkeys are found now in far more places in the lower 48 than they were found pre-European settlement. We've just established them in so many different places that they didn't previously go. And in fact, right now, there seems to be some ecological evidence that they are currently occurring further north in Maine than they did pre-European settlement. Major success.
Whether you're talking about turkeys or geese, mm-hmm. which we talked about just a little bit earlier, or bald eagles, is there a problem ever when there are too many of something? If something's been too successful, I'm thinking, bald eagles are predators. Is that a problem? I have seen a bald eagle. I was out in the field with Jeff Wells, and I saw a bald eagle scoop a duck right out of the Kennebec River. Is that okay?
It is okay. They're predators. They have to eat too. But you're right. When you bring either bring a species back or bring a new species into an environment, it has ripple effects. One of the ripple effects that we've seen with bald eagles in the Gulf of Maine is increasing bald eagle predation on osprey chicks. I've worked for many years at Audubon's Hog Island camp near Bremen, and we've had bald eagles come in and on osprey nests that we have, you know, that Audubon has video cameras on, and the eagles have come in and snatched osprey chicks right out of the nest. That's probably something that was going on for a very long time before there were video cameras, and it's hard to watch. Nature is not always pretty, but where you have rare species, it can become problematic. One of the reasons that the National Audubon Society Seabird Institute, which has sort of taken over a lot of the work that Project Puffin did over the years, one of the reasons that they have young biologists out on these seabird nesting islands all summer is in part to discourage predators like bald eagles from coming in, because there's now so many bald eagles in the Gulf of Maine. A lot of them juvenile birds that don't have any parental responsibilities yet, and they just probably hang out at those nesting colonies and pork out if they weren't being, you know, kind of chased off and hazed off by the people that are there. As far as goose numbers go, by the way, Maine's goose population has increased 46,000% in the last 50 years or so. That has not so much had ecological consequences in Maine, but for some species of geese, like snow geese, which now number in the millions that nest up in the high Canadian Arctic, they've actually degraded a lot of the habitat up there. What had been rich lowland coastal marsh along the Hudson Bay has become kind of mud flats. So yeah, there's good and bad. It's such a thing as being a little too successful with conservation sometimes.
We are talking about bird conservation, focusing on positive results. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are talking about global bird populations. But instead of focusing on the really discouraging news, looking at some of the good news stories, what has worked to help reverse the decline of some species? Our guests are ornithologist and author Scott Wiedensahl. His new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Also with us, Noah Perlett with the University of New England's School of Marine and Environmental Programs. He's also president of the Nuttall Ornithological Club, which is the oldest ornithological organization in America. If you're quick, you can get your question in. Please send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Todd calling from Rumford. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Hey, what an amazing time of year. We have so many birds coming through on their way up to the Arctic, Hudson Bay, or Newfoundland. And I've seen stuff that I don't recognize. Maybe they're incidentals. Maybe they're, I've been to see the Stellar Sea Eagle down in Booth Bay, but I also went to Newfoundland for a month last year and got to see the Stellars in person, got to see gannet rookeries. But then all of a sudden the other day I'm riding my bike up in Rumford and I see this bird flying down the Swift River and I'm like, oh my God, that's the Stellars. It's huge. It's got the orange beak. It's got everything, but it's too white. And then I'm like looking through my books. I'm looking on the internet and I'm like, that thing, what is it? Is it a goose? And it's just fun to like have these things come through and they come through for a short time. And are we seeing more rarities due to climate disruption or what?
That's a good question. Are we seeing more rarities because of climate disruption? Are we seeing more rarities because there's more people birding? Or do we know the answer? Scott, do you know?
That's a really good question. I suspect it is as much more more people out looking than anything else. What we're certainly seeing in New England are species that were not here before that are colonizing farther and farther north. And this has been going on for a while. There was a time when tufted titmice were kind of a, you know, a rare bird alert species, and people were driving long distance to see them. And now they're pretty much everywhere. Oh yeah, and red-bellied woodpeckers. You know, they've expanded all the way up into the Canadian Maritimes at this point. You know, they're sort of on a march. I spent most of my life in Pennsylvania. I can remember when red-bellied woodpeckers in the 1980s were just showing up in central Pennsylvania. That was kind of like a new bird then. Interestingly, there are some birds going the opposite direction. Until the 1980s, merlins, you know, these dark, fast-moving little falcons that are not quite as big as a peregrine, bigger than a kestrel, they didn't breed south of the Canadian border. And then some switch flipped in their ecology, and they've expanded all the way down the Appalachian Mountains. They're now breeding as far south as North Carolina. So we've got some birds moving north. We've got some birds moving south. Bird populations are dynamic, and that's one of the exciting things about being a birder and doing bird research, is because you never know what's going to change. You never know what's going to happen. Okay. Noah, you got any other insights on that?
Yeah, I mean, so you're talking about vagrancy, right? When an individual of a species shows up in seemingly an odd place, and I agree with Scott that we have more eyes on the sky than ever before, and that's super exciting. That being said, you know, vagrancy is a part of ecological history. It's always happened, you know, where birds have, whether it's weather that's moved a bird, or food, or just some strange thing. And that is a really important part of ecology, because as you're seeing with this stellar seagull, sometimes during vagrancy, the bird shows up and then actually ends up recruiting into a breeding population of a species that is not its own, right? And so then they ended up adding new genes to that, and different things happened in evolutionary history. It's extraordinarily rare, but it's real and common all around the world.
Todd, thanks for your question. Go ahead, Scott.
I was just gonna say that one thing where there's a very direct Maine and New England connection is that we're seeing increasing numbers of Western hummingbird species showing up in the Northeast in fall and early winter. Species like rufous hummingbirds, broad-tailed hummingbirds, calliope hummingbirds that, you know, aren't supposed to be here. And these are probably birds that were born with bad software. You know, most migration is genetically based. You're born with a set of instructions to fly in a certain direction at a certain time of the year for a certain length of time. And anything genetic is subject to mutation. And so you get these birds with a hiccup in the system. So you get a rufous hummingbird, which instead of flying due south out of the Pacific Northwest into the mountains of Mexico, hangs a left and ends up in, you know, Bath. You know, last fall, I got a call from Derek Lovitch in Freeport at the Wild Bird Store, that there was an adult female rufous hummingbird coming to a feeder just outside of Bath, and went up and was able to catch the bird and band it. I've got federal and state bird banding permits, and I've been banding hummingbirds for more than 20 years. And, you know, this was in November, and it got really cold. And in fact, that hummingbird remained at that feeder through much of December. Temperature dropped. It survived multiple sub-zero nights. These are tough birds. And what we've been seeing in the last 50 years or so is the evolution of a new migratory route and new wintering areas. Most of these hummingbirds that are coming through here in late fall and early winter end up eventually moving down into the Gulf region and spending the winter down there and then heading back. And, you know, Noah mentioned before these advances in tracking technology. There are now tracking devices that weigh a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a gram, about as big as a grain of rice, that you can put on the back of a hummingbird. They're solar powered. They connect through the Internet of Things via Bluetooth, And I have colleagues down in Alabama and Florida who've been tracking these hummingbirds, on their migration all the way back up into the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. So
That's
just
fascinating. So
extraordinary
this
things.
little hummingbird, the western hummingbird that showed up in Bath and survived the frost, did it survive the winter?
It did. It stuck around for it stuck around through about the end of January. And my prediction to the and it was a lovely couple that were hosting this. I have found that hummingbirds have the best taste in human hosts. It's always they're always the nicest. I said, what will probably happen now that it's gotten really cold and we've had some snow, it will probably wait for a bit of a warm spell. And you'll probably see it at the feeder, just kind of hanging out at the feeder all morning long, and then it'll disappear about midday. And that's exactly what happened because hummingbirds are for the most part diurnal migrants. They migrate during the day. Most of our birds migrate at night, and that's exactly what happened. So she would show up in the morning at this heated feeder and feed, and then one day she was just sitting there and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking, just filling up her gas tank. And she took off, and I suspect she spent the winter down in, Pascagoula or Biloxi or someplace like that,
So
in
she was
some.
tanking up and then got out of town.
Exactly.
Noah, here's a question from Jay, an email from Jay. I designed a bumper sticker for Audubon that says Maine is for plovers. What's the outlook for plovers in southern Maine? I ask you because UNE is right in plover territory, isn't it?
Absolutely. And honestly, I think that what goes on in our beaches for both piping plovers and least terns is perhaps the most fascinating bird success story in our state. In 1983, there were a total of six pairs of piping plovers in Maine, a total of six. Last summer, there was 174 pairs of piping plovers on our beaches, some of which nested on islands that the species had never been recorded nesting on it. Likewise, in the late 1970s, there was 55 pairs of least terns. Last summer, there was 213, right? And so that you think about that growth, like that's a pretty long time, right? From the 1970s to now, it's whatever, almost 50 years. However, we're talking about a habitat that is not growing. In fact, it's shrinking. And there's less habitat and there's more people that want to use those habitats. And so there's more, potential effective conflict, you could say, for lack of a better term. And so the management by Maine Audubon and Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, in collaboration with all the towns that they're nesting in, who have all been part of this recovery, is just spectacular. And I think it's so great that my kids, and I live in Scarborough, my kids will never know a beach that doesn't have these birds nesting on it because they've been here for their whole lives. And that's just so incredibly exciting.
An email here from Jeannie. As someone who cares about birds, what can I do to help with conservation slash protection of birds other than just feeding them? Scott.
Couple of quick things. One of the most important is if you have a cat, please keep it in the house because cats kill between 2 and 4 billion birds in the United States every year. It doesn't matter how well you feed your cat. It doesn't, even if you don't think your cat is killing birds, your cat is killing birds. Garden with native plants because that way you're binding up broken ecological connections in your backyard and creating food resources for birds, especially insects, because most birds are feeding on insects during the summertime. Please be organic if you're doing that. And by the way, if you need help with native plant gardening, Maine Audubon is a phenomenal resource for that. They have a big native plant sale. An odd one is if you drink coffee, seek out and purchase certified shade-grown coffee, which is grown in rich, intact, biodiverse forests in Latin America. There are a number of certification programs out there. By far, the best one is the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center's Bird Friendly Certification. Bird Friendly Certified coffee is USDA organic certified, and the habitat it protects is mostly our small family farms in Latin America. It's really rich migratory habitat and wintering habitat for all of these beautiful neotropical migrants, the warblers and vireos and thrushes and tanagers and orioles that we get here in the summertime. Our hummingbirds, our ruby-throated hummingbirds are down there. And I've seen with my own eyes the impact that's made in places like northern Nicaragua, where the premium price that that the farmers are getting for that coffee is allowing them to actually reforest degraded land and create new bird habitat.
Well, thank you for those tips. And that's going to be the last word today. Thank you both for being on the program today. The voice you just heard, ornithologist and author Scott Wiedensahl. He's the author of more than 30 books. His latest, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Also with us for the hour, Dr. Noah Perlett, Assistant Academic Director for the University of New England School of Marine and Environmental Programs. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.